Welcome to our first presentation and for the Sunday evening call-in sessions and the new year. And we're just very delighted by our guest, and we actually have two guests. We have a guest introducer, Beth Elliott, and Beth has headed the group Families for Borderline Personality Disorder Research, which has raised the money to enable two NARSED grants to be awarded to junior investigators for borderline personality disorder research to help them launch productive research programs to contribute the knowledge that we need. And this is the second in this series. Let me stop with that and turn over to Beth.
Hi, everyone. I'd like to introduce Dr. Brad Riesch from McLean Hospital. He's been there since 1990. He's been a psychiatrist in charge of many treatment units and programs, including one called the Affective Disorder Program. He's an instructor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's also a researcher with many publications, and his main area of research interest is investigating and understanding affective instability in borderline and bipolar II. Two things that you won't know about him is that he used to be a New York City taxi cab driver, and he also was a bicycle messenger in San Francisco. And so we, as Families for BBD Research, including Pat Porter, are really honored to provide the funding for him for his 2012 NARSED Young Investigator Award. And we were also honored to have brunch with him yesterday. Pat Porter, myself, Amanda Wang, and some lovely family members were at a restaurant in the middle of Times Square that had this huge fireplace, and it was very warm and cozy. And Brad was fun to have brunch with. He was so interesting, informative, and helpful. And I turn you over to Brad.
So, Beth, thank you very much for that introduction with all its diverse elements, and thank you again for your hospitality yesterday in New York. I'm going to talk for the next 35 to 45 minutes or so about a topic which I think is really important, that is affective instability and borderline personality disorder. And just to preview what I'm going to talk about, I'm just going to talk about, you know, a definition of it, some of its characteristics. I'm also going to talk about some studies looking at affective instability, both sort of in real time and also in terms of retrospective reports. I'm going to talk about affective instability in BPD compared to other personality disorders, and also talk about the very important topic which I'm investigating, which is affective instability in borderline personality disorder compared to bipolar disorder. I'm going to talk some about, the course of affective instability over time and whether it's associated with factors such as childhood trauma. And then I'm going to talk about possible treatments for affective instability in borderline personality disorder. So let me talk first about sort of what is affective instability. Well, some of its characteristics are, first of all, that it involves very rapid shifts between different emotional states. And these shifts usually involve, for borderline patients anyway, negative emotions like anxiety, depression, and anger. These shifts can occur either spontaneously or more frequently, perhaps, in response to events that happen to borderline patients. But I should also say that, at least in terms of the DSM-4, and I think the clinical lore that's out there about borderline patients, their affective instability tends to be thought of as more reactive to events. So what is the DSM-4 definition of affective instability? Well, it talks about it as being a marked reactivity of mood, which can involve intense episodic dysphoria. That is, dysphoria sort of means just feeling bad, irritability or anxiety, which usually lasts a few hours and typically doesn't last for more than a few days. I mean, if you get beyond a day or two, I think that's a long time for borderline patients in a particular mood state. The DSM-IV says that, that borderline patients have a basic dysphoric mood. I'm not sure that's true, but certainly many of them do feel dysphoric most of the time. And then they have these fluctuations, which may involve anger, panic, despair, are only rarely relieved by periods of well-being or satisfaction, again, at least according to the DSM-IV. So why is affective instability important in borderline personality disorder? Well, if you look at studies that try to distill out the key features of this disorder, usually the studies find that there are three key features. One of them is impulsivity, a second is interpersonal problems, and the last is affective instability. Now, there's one study which looked at the relationship between affective instability and other borderline personality disorder symptoms, and this was done by Harold Königsberg and his group at Mount Sinai back in 2001. And what the study found was that affective instability was associated with other symptoms such as emptiness, inappropriate anger, identity disturbance, suicidal attempts, threats, or acts. So it looks as though there are a number of aspects of BPD which may be associated or hinge upon, to some degree, affective instability. There are three basic features of affective instability, or dimensions, if you will, and I'm going to be talking about all three tonight in various ways. The first is the frequency of mood or affective changes, that is, how often they occur. The second is the amplitude of the mood change, that is, when someone goes from feeling depressed to feeling anxious, for example, how anxious do they feel? Is it an intense change? And the last characteristic or dimension is temporal dependency, that is, sequencing of mood changes. So if you're anxious, are you more likely to become depressed? If you're feeling angry, are you more likely to become anxious? And so forth. So I'll be talking about all three aspects or features of affective instability. So how is affective instability studied? Well, there are two basic ways. One is by obtaining information from subjects or patients in real time, having them report their moods or mood changes over a period which might range from a week to a month. And the second way is through retrospective self-reports, that is, asking subjects to reflect on or report the number of affective changes, the intensity of those affective changes, and so forth, over a period of time after it's occurred. We're going to talk about both tonight, and let me talk about the first study, which used concurrent self-report to measure affective instability in BPD. This was done by Rex Cowdery back at the NIMH back in 1991. And he looked at four different groups, 16 patients with borderline personality disorder, 10 with major depression, 15 with premenstrual syndrome, and 24 normals. And he asked them to rate their mood using a visual scale that he put in front of them. And on one end was the worst they've ever felt, and on the other end is the best they've ever felt. And he studied subjects in these four groups over a period of 14 days, asking them to rate their mood once in the morning and once in the evening. And what he found was that patients with borderline personality disorder and premenstrual syndrome had a greater variability greater changes from morning to morning, that is, from the morning one day to the morning the next day, and also greater changes from evening one day to evening the next day in comparison to patients who had major depression or who were normal controls. He also found that subjects with borderline personality disorder and subjects with premenstrual syndrome had greater variability from morning to evening, so over the course of a day. And last of all, he found that borderline subjects had more random variability of their mood than subjects in the other three groups. So their rating at one particular time did not necessarily correlate it or correlated the most weakly with the rating at another period of time compared to all the other groups. And I actually included a slide which illustrates this quite well, showing that if you look at the lines comparing Borderline's report of moods in the morning and in the evening compared to the other groups, you see the lines for the Borderlines just move back and forth a lot more. So I want to talk for a couple of minutes about the technique called ecological momentary assessment. And that is an attempt to measure mood states and other symptoms, for that matter, in real time. And what researchers will do is they will give subjects diaries or, more recently, Palm Pilots and ask them to rate their mood or other symptoms at different time points during the day for a certain period of time. And this has several advantages over retrospective reports. One is that you're actually measuring what's going on in the subject's natural environment. And the second is that it doesn't rely on memory, which some would say is not particularly accurate when it comes to remembering mood states or other things for that matter. So there's one study of this which was done by Tim Troll and his group in 2008. And what he did was he asked 34 patients with BPD and 26 patients with major depression or dysthymia to use Palm Pilots to rate their moods over a period of 28 days, so for a month. And he asked them to do this six times a day. And he asked them to describe their mood using a scale called the PANAS, that is the positive and negative affect scale. And when he analyzed the data, he focused in particular on three emotions or moods that I think are particularly problematic for borderline patients. The first was hostility, the second was fear or anxiety, and the last was sadness or depression. And what he found was, compared to patients who had major depression but did not have borderline personality disorder, that the borderline patients didn't report overall differences in positive and negative emotions. But he did find that borderline patients had a lot more variability over time, both in positive and in negative emotions. And in particular, it looked as though when borderline patients started to have a negative emotion like sadness, hostility, or fear, they had a much larger response continuing to become more sad, more hostile, more fearful than patients with major depression or dysthymia. So this is a real-time study which showed there's more variability, and in some respects borderline mood changes are more intense than those patients with major depression and dysthymia. Now, one of the things that I've been interested in is retrospective self-report, and I'm going to talk some about the studies out there that have been done looking at the memories of borderline patients for their mood changes over time. And those studies tend to use two different questionnaires. The first is the affect intensity measure, also known as the AIM. And the second is the affective lability scale, also known as the ALS. And these two questionnaires tend to measure affective traits, that is sort of general emotional characteristics over time, as opposed to affective states, that is how someone is feeling in a particular moment or for a fairly narrowly defined period of time. I think it's also important to mention that both these questionnaires were designed for populations of normal subjects, not for patients, which makes any interpretation of the results using these somewhat tentative. So I'll talk first about the AIM, that is the affect intensity measure. This is a 40-item questionnaire which contains both positive and negative emotions. There are three items which pertain to guilt, six which pertain to anxiety, one which pertains to anger, two which pertain to general emotional distress, and one that pertains to sadness. And subjects are asked to rate each item on a 6-point scale, 1 meaning never, 2 almost never, 3 occasionally, 4 usually, 5 almost always, and 6 always. Now, let me talk for a minute about the affective lability scale, which I think in some ways is more useful clinically. This is a 54-item scale, and each item is rated on 4 points, and the items pertain to an actual emotion. It may pertain to a behavior associated with that emotion, or it might pertain to thoughts that go along with that emotion. And again, each item is rated on a 4-point scale, a 1 being very uncharacteristic, 2 being somewhat uncharacteristic, 3 being somewhat characteristic, and the number 4 being a very characteristic. So these are very general sort of anchor points that are used here. I want to emphasize that. But from this scale, you can generate 6 subscales, which I think have relevance to borderline personality disorder. At least I would say that 4 of the 6 do. The first involves changes from feeling okay to feeling angry. The second involves changes from feeling okay to feeling anxious. The third involves changes from feeling okay to feeling depressed. The fourth involves changes between anxiety and depression. And the last two, the fifth pertains to changes between feeling okay and feeling elated, so not something we typically see in borderline patients. And the last scale pertains to changes between depression and elation, again, not something you typically see in borderline patients. So let me talk for a minute about the application of these two questionnaires to affective instability in BPD as it compares to affective instability in other personality disorders. And there was a very nice study that was done back in 2002 by Harold Koenigsberg and his group using the ALS and the AIM to assess affective instability in 42 patients with BPD and 110 patients with other personality disorders besides BPD. And what this study found, first of all, was that borderline patients didn't show overall ratings on the affect intensity measure, which were significantly higher than those of other personality disorders. But borderline patients did have higher ratings on the affective lability scales that involved anger, anxiety, and depression anxiety compared to patients with other personality disorders. And again, I think this is what one observes clinically, that borderline patients struggle with a lot of anxiety, anger, and sometimes they have shifts between depression and anxiety. They can't get out of those two states. So let me now talk about affective instability in BPD and bipolar disorder, because I think this is it's a very important topic, in part because patients with BPD are frequently misdiagnosed as having bipolar disorder. And this can lead to inappropriate treatment. From my perspective, it often focuses too much on pharmacotherapy as the answer and not enough on psychotherapy. There's one study that was done down in Rhode Island that looked at a group of patients coming into a clinic who'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and actually determined that when you used rigorous diagnostic instruments, you found that 24% of those patients diagnosed with bipolar disorder actually had BPD instead. And I see this all the time, to the point that when a patient comes to me and they tell me they have bipolar disorder, I'm often skeptical until I get more information. So there's one group of researchers that have proposed for a number of years now, actually, that BPD is actually part of the bipolar spectrum and is produced by what they call a cyclothymic temperament. That is a vulnerability to have frequent mood swings back and forth between different states. This group is headed by Dr. Hagip Kiskel, who's published a number of papers with his colleagues trying to substantiate this point of view. And he would claim, in fact, that BPD doesn't exist. Maybe now he would say it does exist, but that there's certainly many patients who have BPD who are really much more bipolar. Also, when one thinks about the possibility that there's an overlap between borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder, there you look at the literature, which shows that many of the same medications which treat affective instability in BPD also are effective in bipolar disorder. And there are a number of medications which actually have migrated over from the treatment of bipolar disorder into the treatment of BPD. The two most prominent being lamotrigine and valproic acid. I will talk some about them at the very end of the talk tonight. So there are a number of researchers who would actually argue with Dr. O'Kiskel and his group and say that borderline patients really are a distinct diagnostic entity and are not bipolar at all. And they focus on a number of points. One is that the mood reactivity in BPD and bipolar disorder are actually defined differently. Bipolar disorder does not, the definition for that does not usually involve reactive mood swings, although there is some evidence that bipolar patients, in fact, are quite reactive in some ways. Also, if you look at patients with BPD and look for diagnoses that tend to accompany it, you find that bipolar disorder is not one of the more common diagnoses accompanying BPD. In fact, post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression, and substance abuse occur more commonly. Last of all, when you look at studies of personality disorders in patients who have bipolar disorder, you find that there are a number of personality disorders that show up, and BPD is no more common than other personality disorders. So I'm very interested in this topic, and I developed a self-report questionnaire, which I'm going to talk about for a few minutes, to assess different types of affective instability. And I call it the ALQ-BPD, that is the Affective Lability Questionnaire for Borderline Personality Disorder. This is a self-report. Covers a one-week period, so it asks patients and subjects to reflect on what happened over the last week. It has 10 items, and these items, except for the last, each have two parts. The first asks about the frequency of mood changes of a particular kind, and the second asks about intensity of mood changes of a particular kind. And I can use the instrument, the questionnaire, to generate subscales for frequency and intensity for patients who take the ALQ, that is the questionnaire. So this questionnaire measures a number of different types of mood swings, and some of them are similar to what's measured in the affective lability scale. Some of them I have added on, and I'll list the different mood shifts. The first is a shift between feeling okay and feeling depressed. The second is a shift between feeling okay and feeling anxious. The third is a shift between feeling okay and feeling angry. The fourth is a shift between feeling depressed and feeling anxious. The fifth is a shift between feeling anxious and feeling depressed. The next is between feeling depressed and feeling angry. Then there's also an item involving shifts between feeling angry and feeling depressed. And the next to last item involves shifts between feeling anxious and feeling angry. And the last item involves a shift between feeling angry and feeling anxious. And in particular, I thought there might be some association between anxiety and anger in borderline patients, because what I found is that when borderline patients and people in general are more edgy and anxious, they're often more vulnerable to becoming angry. So each item in my questionnaire, when it comes to frequency, has four different possible ratings. So it runs from 0 to 4. The first is no mood shifts in that particular area. Second is once a week. The third is 2 to 3 times per week. The last is once per day. And actually, the number 4, the very last one, is more than once per day. And then when it comes to intensity, there are four different possibilities for each particular shift. One is a slight change in intensity. So if you go from feeling depressed to feeling anxious, you get slightly anxious. The second is a moderate change. A subject will say they experience moderate anxiety when they go from feeling depressed to feeling anxious. The third possibility is a large shift from one mood to the next, and the last is an extreme shift, so a very high shift, say, between feeling anxious and feeling angry. And there's one additional item at the end of this questionnaire to address the question I'm very interested in, which is how reactive are the changes in mood for borderline patients to events, and in particular to interpersonal events. And so I asked patients to rate the extent to which, or the percentage of the time, they felt their mood changes were reactive to an interpersonal event, and on a scale of 0 to 100. So I used this questionnaire to study 818 undergraduates at a large university, and wanted to see whether patients who diagnosed themselves as borderline had different profiles of affective instability compared to those who diagnosed themselves as being bipolar. And what we found was that patients with BPD reported more frequent emotional shifts in a number of dimensions. They said they tended to go from feeling okay to feeling depressed more frequently. They went from feeling okay to feeling anxious more frequently. They went from feeling anxious to feeling depressed more frequently. They went from feeling depressed to feeling anxious more frequently. And they also reported shifts between depression and anger more frequently than bipolar subjects. Subjects with bipolar disorder also reported more intense shifts in two areas. They said when they went from feeling okay to feeling depressed, the depression was more severe than those of bipolar patients. And when they went from feeling anxious to depressed, the depression was also more severe compared to bipolar patients. Compared to patients who were bipolar, the borderline subjects reported that their emotional shifts tended to be more frequently reactive to interpersonal events. But interestingly, if you looked at the actual numbers here, both borderline and bipolar subjects reported emotional shifts that in reaction to interpersonal events that occurred less than 50% of the time. That is, the borderline patients identified their mood changes over 50% of the time as not occurring in reaction to something that was interpersonal. Now, I'm not sure whether, in fact, that was the case or whether these subjects, who were probably not patients, actually weren't able to recognize that their emotional shifts were in reaction to something. So this came as a surprise to me, and I actually have some other data, which I'm not going to talk about in detail tonight, using Palm Pilots, which would back this up, which would say that borderlines actually do experience a number of mood shifts which are not in reaction to events going on around them. All right, so there is some evidence that affective instability in BPD is different compared to patients who have bipolar disorders, different compared to patients with other personality disorders. How do we understand what might be causing this? Well, there's one study that looked at the association between affective instability and childhood trauma. It was published in 2003, and it looked at 61 patients with BPD and 133 patients with other personality disorders. And it used the affective lability scale, which I talked about earlier, and also the affect intensity measure, which I talked about, and obtained ratings of childhood trauma using a questionnaire, which was self-report called the Childhood Trauma Questionnaire. And interestingly, this study found that there was no significant correlation between a reported history of childhood abuse and either the intensity or frequency of mood changes for BPD patients. I was surprised by this because my thinking as a clinician had been, well, if someone comes from a traumatic environment, which is chaotic, unstable, it would be very difficult to learn how to regulate one's emotions and it would be very difficult to have a stable emotional life. But it turns out that there doesn't seem to be any association between at least patients' reports of childhood trauma and affective instability. And in fact, it looks as though in one study that came out of Vancouver and that at least 50% of affective instability is probably related to hereditary factors. We're not sure, you know, exactly what those are, but there seems to be some strong genetic basis for this. But what happens to affective instability over time? Well, it actually is one of the symptoms of BPD which improves most rapidly. In a study by my colleague Mary Zanarini, she found that After 6 years, only 40% of those patients with borderline personality disorder who had initially reported affective instability as a problem continued to report it. And after 10 years, that percentage declined to 13%. Now, what I would say is that from my perspective, affective instability is something which is very much stress-related. And as borderline patients learn how to manage the environment around them and hopefully encounter ways to manage stress more effectively over time, perhaps they're less vulnerable to increases in affective instability. However, I think that when borderline patients encounter stress that's beyond their control, they often experience an increase in affective instability as well as other symptoms. And there's no research on this, but that's my clinical impression. How does one go about treating affective instability? Well, one way to do that is with DBT. As many of you may know, DBT actually has two modules which are directly relevant to affective instability. One is the affect regulation module, and the second is the distress tolerance. You heard me say just a minute ago that from my perspective, affective instability is very much related to stress or distress. And so if you have very little tolerance of that, you're more vulnerable to increases in affective instability. And there is, in fact, one study which showed that using DBT skills applied over 1 year was actually associated with reductions in affective instability using a self-report instrument. Transference-focused psychotherapy can also be useful in treating affective instability. And while there's no research on this, the essence of TFP is that it tries to help patients tolerate ambivalence, positive and negative emotions toward individuals in their lives simultaneously over time. And that in itself, from my perspective, holding on to two emotions simultaneously would reduce affective instability and the tendency to oscillate between one affective state and another. There is some research showing that TFP and as well as schema-focused therapy improve affective instability over time. That was published in 2006. One can also use medications to treat affective instability. I don't think they're as effective, but they're commonly used, and it's useful to know about which ones might be helpful. We did a study in 2009 looking at the treatment of affective instability with lamotrigine and found that patients who took lamotrigine were significantly more likely to report decreases in overall affective instability than patients with BPD who did not use lamotrigine. There's also a study of the medication aripiprazole, which found that it can reduce affective instability, or at least some of the emotions that go along with it, such as anger and anxiety. And finally, there's some evidence that the medication valproic acid may be useful in reducing affective instability over time. My own belief is, in looking at the pluses and minuses of these medications, probably lamotrigine is the first one to use simply because it has the fewest side effects. Aripiprazole has more side effects, including the possibility of getting more anxious or more agitated. It can also cause weight gain. And valproic acid, while it may be quite effective, has a whole host of side effects associated with it, most prominently weight gain. You can also get hair loss, acne, and other problems. So I'm reluctant to use that unless it's really kind of a last-ditch effort. So let me finish up by talking about the clinical implications of what I've discussed earlier tonight. I think the first is that you can't see affective instability as a unitary phenomenon. That is one thing. So when a patient or family member tells you, you know, I'm having a lot of mood swings, you want to find out what exactly are those mood swings. Are they shifts between being feeling okay and feeling anxious, between feeling depressed and feeling angry? You want to get down to the specifics, because borderline patients talk about a lot of mood swings, and for that reason they're often labeled bipolar, but when you find out the specific mood swings they're having, you hear that they're really not particularly bipolar, because bipolar patients talk about moving into elation at least some of the time, which you rarely see with borderline patients. The second important point is that affective instability may improve over time. I think that that applies to all of us. As we get older, our moods tend to be more stable. We may be less reactive to things. And certainly there are many patients that I've seen who have BPD who, as teenagers or young adults, complain of a lot of instability of mood as well as instability of behavior. And as they get into their late 20s or 30s, that tends to even out. A third point is that affective instability in BPD can be clearly differentiated from the affective instability in bipolar disorder from my perspective. So if you have a family member, a friend, who is diagnosed with bipolar disorder based on mood swings, I think, again, you want to sort of find out what are the mood swings. Are these really bipolar-type mood swings, which more typically involve changes involving elation, or at least occasionally, especially at particular times of year? The next point is that actually attending to affective instability, trying to monitor it, may in itself be therapeutic. I can't tell you how many subjects in my studies I found said to me, yeah, you know, this was really interesting to look at my mood changes over the last week, because I wasn't aware how unstable I was, and it actually gave me a handle, or the beginnings of a handle, for dealing with that. The next point is that multiple forms of psychotherapy appear effective in treating affective instability. I haven't talked at all about mentalization-based treatment. That might be helpful, although there's no literature on this. But I think any good psychotherapy will probably or should address this in some way. Next, although medication treatment may be helpful for affective instability, it's much less likely to benefit a borderline patient than a bipolar patient. It's not that I wouldn't use medication to treat affective instability in someone who has BPD, but I would keep my expectations modest. Even if they report a 20 or 30 or 40% improvement, that actually would be pretty good. And there really aren't any medications that I'm aware of which block the tendency to become more affectively unstable under stress. I want to make one other point, which is that I think, you know, I've talked a lot about shifts from one mood state to another tonight as though these things occur in some pure fashion, that people, borderline patients and people in general, but particularly borderline patients, may go from a pure state of feeling okay to a pure state of feeling depressed. I think, in fact, borderline patients are in mixed mood states a great deal of the time, where they feel depressed and anxious simultaneously, or anxious and angry simultaneously, and that's an area that I'm just beginning to explore, because I think it really captures what the reality is much better than research which says, you know, you're moving directly from a state where you feel okay to one where you're feeling anxious or angry or depressed in some pure way. So that's really all I had prepared. I'll take any questions which people have.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, there are some questions, but first, Beth, from your discussion with Brad at lunch, you had a number of good things, and I don't want to get started on these without giving you the opportunity to, if you wish, to present those that you found most interesting.
Well, one in particular, Brad, when you were talking about bipolar types of mood swings and the different seasons, could you just elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yes. From my perspective, many, if not the majority of bipolar patients have mood changes which are somewhat seasonal, and they tend to be more depressed starting in the late summer. That's really the first wave that I see, usually running up all the way until the holidays, New Year's, and their depression may persist in some cases into February or March. But starting with the new year, bipolar patients are more vulnerable to becoming manic as the days are getting longer. And that tends to crescendo, usually starting in March or April and ending sometime in June. So there often is really a seasonal pattern that I'm alert for, which you tend not to see in patients who have borderline personality disorder who don't have bipolar disorder or don't have depressive disorders. I mean, you can have unipolar depression, which is quite seasonal as well, which tends to get worse starting in late summer and often, you know, tends to crescendo between, I'd say, Halloween and Christmas.
So that's... Beth, did you want to follow up, or
Just one more question. You're going to be looking at the neurological distinction between BBD and bipolar too, and I was wondering what your working hypothesis is about that, if you expect it to be part of continuum or separate subtypes of affective instability.
Well, that's a good question. I think what we're going to find is that when you present borderline patients with faces that appear anxious, you get a neurobiological profile using an MRI, which is going to look different. I think you're going to find that their amygdala is much more reactive and that probably the structures in the prefrontal cortex, which are used to modulate emotions, have to work harder and probably light up more than what you're going to see with type 2 bipolar patients.
Thanks.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
Sure.
Anything else, Beth?
No, thanks.
Okay. What, Brad, before the holidays, we had a special session following up on the tragic massacre in Newtown at the elementary school. And no surprise that many families with a borderline member had a latent concern, really just on the edge, that their borderline member might engage in such an act. And for females, of course, that doesn't seem to be likely. The risk there is suicide. For males, we don't see them much in clinical, because they tend to be getting into antisocial and wind up in the prisons, so it's less clear, but probably not high. But behind all this, actually, from the violence with the mentally ill, is not the these really serious, dramatic, media-grabbing, and very tragic events, but attacks, verbal and physical, toward family members and acquaintances for everybody are the most common. And a lot of unease there among family members and kind of, well, walking around around the eggshells for fear that something's going to be triggered. Is that something that you encounter frequently?
With male borderlines, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, male borderlines are often different and struggle more with externalization of anger more than female borderlines. But, you know, borderline patients act impulsively. Their aggression is usually very impulsive. It's not really planned. And so, I mean, I suppose if, you know, you had weapons lying around the house that were readily accessible, yes, that could be of some concern, but they're not going to go through the elaborate planning that a paranoid schizophrenic would go through and when it came to hurting people and using weapons. So, I mean, I think that being around borderline patients can be difficult when they get angry at you, and yes, they can be somewhat destructive, but usually that destructiveness does not turn to serious violence. That's my impression anyway. You know, if patients have antisocial personality disorder that's comorbid with BPD, that's another matter altogether.
Right. Well, there you have a long history to look at and base to worry about. I think it's the fear that out of the blue, out of these little rumblings and encounters they have in family interactions and so forth, that there will be this explosion. And I think your experience there should be very, very reassuring.
I mean, what I think about concerns with weapons with borderline patients really has much more to do with the potential for suicide than with the potential for homicide or assault.
Self-directed. As a clarification question, you were doing so well, I didn't want to interrupt, but a lot of people have had, you know, their family member initially has been diagnosed with bipolar, and only after some time and some difficulty, also because the consumer or the family said, gee, we've come across the criteria, and the family member or the consumer, they said 8 out of 9 or 9 out of 9 criteria, they really must have borderline, and kind of pushed it. But in looking at what's kind of the key thing that you would, key thing or things that you would look at if a patient comes in that quickly kind of sets you toward borderline diagnosis versus bipolar? Is it the affective instability or something else?
Well, I think affective instability often coupled with the interpersonal problems. But if someone comes in and they start talking about mood swings, right, and I'll never forget one patient I treated in the hospital, you know, she'd been diagnosed as bipolar, and she had what seemed to me to be a lot of the misery that you see with borderline patients. And but she was convinced that she was bipolar and ultimately wound up getting, had psychosurgery, had a cingulotomy for it. I remember seeing her after that, and it was sad because she really wasn't that much better. You know, and I would have diagnosed her as having borderline personality disorder, but she was very invested in the bipolar diagnosis. What I would say is that rapid shifts between one state and an anxious state, whether it's depression, anxiety, anger, anxiety, euthymia, anxiety, that's more characteristic of borderline patients. Rapid shifts into anger from different other emotional states, whether it's feeling okay or feeling depressed or whatever, that is very characteristic of borderline patients. And also really asking them, you know, do their moods tend to be reactive a lot of the time? You know, when someone says the wrong thing to them, do they react very strongly and very quickly? Bipolar patients in general will not endorse that. And they will also describe changes in their mood, which in general are more gradual. They may be abrupt, but, you know, they don't have mood changes several times a day. I mean, I think it's really the frequency component also that's critical. Borderline patients have more frequent mood changes than bipolar patients. Does that answer your question?
I think so. I'm kind of relaying and sometimes paraphrasing something to – you don't want to go into individual clinical cases when you can't see the person and examine them. So I'm kind of trying to make it a little bit more general. The other thing is, do you have cases, though, patients with both bipolar, borderline, and bipolar? Mary Zanarini has mentioned that as the longitudinal study has continued, bipolar has gone from, bipolar 2 particularly, has gone from like 1% of the sample to 3%, 5% up. And the question is, what patient look like that has both bipolar and borderline?
Well, the first point is that having BPD actually, I think, is a risk factor for having bipolar disorder. Again, the two are different, but in general, patients with BPD are more likely to develop bipolar disorder than patients with other personality disorders. I believe that's what they found in the CLIP study. Excuse me. The second is that, you know, I see them as sort of having two different dimensions. So a patient who reports going into somewhat prolonged periods of depression and then possibly coming out of those for brief periods of time or longer periods of time into a state which feels kind of elated, up, They're sleeping less. They have a lot more energy. They may talk about, you know, feeling more creative than usual. And they often talk about a sort of pressure, you know, behind this, which doesn't seem to be particularly reactive. It's something which is very internal. That's what I look for when I want to make a bipolar diagnosis. And when I think about more the day-to-day reactivity in mood and so forth, that's much more borderline. And I tend to think of the day-to-day reactivity as being something that one would focus on more with therapy, maybe secondarily with medication, whereas the more bipolar mood reactivity tends to be, I mean, psychotherapy is helpful for bipolar patients. I'm not saying it isn't helpful, but I do think that without medication, it can be very difficult to control these prolonged swings into depression or rapid swings into elation or more extended swings into elation. Does that answer the question?
I think so. And the other part of that was, is the treatment protocol, do you just follow the treatment protocol for bipolar and for borderline when they're together, or is in some way is the treatment protocols affected because they're kind of concurrent?
Well, I think the treatment is overlapping in many ways. But for someone who has pure BPD or BPD without bipolar disorder, I tend to think that psychotherapy is really the mainstay of treatment. And if you look at people who, in some of these psychotherapy trials over time, they as they get better, they're on less medication. Someone who's bipolar, you have to be attentive to the medication. You know, you can't keep a bipolar patient on an antidepressant without a mood stabilizer as you're getting into the spring, if they have any history of manic episodes in the spring. So it really does complicate things, and there is more of a focus on biological treatments, although some of the same principles that apply to borderline personality disorder, which can involve mood monitoring and so forth, can also be applied to the treatment of bipolar disorder.
Okay. People are wondering what you're, because you've talked a lot about medication. Would you say that medication is used with almost every patient that you see, or that this is just a proportion of them, or what?
Of the borderline patients?
Yes.
I tend to treat patients who are on the sicker side, so probably most of my patients are on some kind of medication. But one of the problems one encounters with borderline personality disorder, particularly more anxious borderlines, is that they can easily be over-medicated. And some of the sicker patients who don't really have good distress tolerance or affect regulation skills may come to me on, you know, 4, 5, 6 different sedative medications. And so my goal actually is to try to help get them off some of those medications, if that's possible, to teach them skills that involve distress tolerance and affect regulation. But I would say that, you know, the healthier borderline patients over time, sometimes you are able to get them off medication altogether. But you know, I don't see many patients who are fresh to the system, so by the time I see them, they've already been in treatment for a while and therefore probably are on medication. But the goal should be to try to simplify if a patient's on multiple medications, one wants to think periodically, are all these medications necessary, and justify both to yourself and to the patient whether it makes sense to be on these medications. You know, if you start tapering a medication and someone gets more symptomatic, you know they need it. But in some cases, you can actually taper a medication slowly, and you find that the patient's able to get off it, and they're actually doing just as well.
Huh, okay. Yeah, Wayne Fenton, before he was killed by a patient, kind of mentioned that and was urging caution both in prescribing but also probing slowly to fade down rather than just hey, if things are calm now, let's just continue where we are and continue pouring the pills down.
I mean, let me just add that I think it's a tremendous disservice to say to a patient with BPD that medication is going to be the answer. And because I think many, particularly the patients who are more, who struggle more with passivity and have poorer skills, they really are desperate to find some sort of biological cure. And they'll go from one clinician to the next, and sometimes in severe cases they'll wind up getting electroconvulsive therapy when it's really not indicated. So I think one has to be very careful about overselling the benefits of medication with borderline patients.
Yeah, there was enough people getting electroconvulsive therapy in the Pittsburgh area that the people down at Western Psychic were able to do a study about that.
That's right.
And I was thinking, oh, my gosh.
Yep.
But say, we're all directed towards symptom relief, and long-term, there's, for many, there's great encouragement that there will be a substantial remission of symptoms, but only a portion of folks then really recover in terms of work and pursuing school and so forth. Do you get into the recovery aspect with your patients, or is that kind of beyond what insurance and resources can cover and so forth?
Well, no, I think recovery is critical. From my perspective, you know, in, I want people to get symptom relief, but you can't really think about treating someone unless you're focused on functioning. And I'm a strong advocate of people working if that's possible, even though it may be a real challenge. Patients sometimes need to go on disability, but when someone's contemplating going on disability, I always talk about the pros and the cons, and there's certainly a number of cons. Once you sort of stabilize someone symptomatically, and I'm being somewhat artificial about this when I talk in this way, but then you can sort of focus more on, okay, let's get you back to work. But my goal really is to have people, if at all possible, hold on to the highest level of functioning they've been able to achieve recently, and I'm pretty tenacious about doing whatever I can to support that.
What would be some of the ways you would support it?
Well, so if someone's thinking about taking a medical leave from work, I say, well, do you think that really makes sense? If someone is thinking about isolating themselves and not being involved with the world socially, I say, well, what can we do to help you get out there, at least in some limited way socially, and interacting with people? I really want people to be as active as they can be in terms of managing their symptoms and also in terms of trying to hold on to functioning. So, you know, we'll talk, I'll coach people through what it's going to take to stay at a job if someone is feeling that they're being triggered by a coworker or a boss. If someone's trying to isolate themselves too significantly, I'll say, okay, well, look, maybe you should reach out to someone this weekend and make it a point to go out so it does not become too unfamiliar to you. And in most cases, if they're willing to try to be active in that process, they can do a lot. I mean, it's not necessarily something that happens overnight, but people actually can get better.
Yeah. Beth, do you want to follow up on recovery at all? Beth?
Well, actually, I thought about one question when you're talking about Palm Pilots, that we talked about it. Brunch, and you said that you had BPD patients record their emotions, and then you asked them later what their emotions were, and they really remembered their negative emotions quite accurately, but they didn't remember the times they felt okay.
Yes, it's not my work, but that's someone else's work. Yes,
right.
We talked about the fact that if you compare someone's ability to remember what happened over the last 24 hours with the ratings they made during that time, you'll see that for borderline patients, they remember negative emotions pretty well, but they tend to remember fewer positive emotions than they report when they're rating their mood in the moment. And so, as I think we talked about yesterday, some of the work actually is helping people remember that there are times when they do feel better than they're feeling at the moment when they're in intense distress, and helping them hold on to memories of positive moments as a way of getting through the more difficult moments.
Do you have any advice to parents and families how to encourage BPD family members to do that?
Well, I think it's tricky because sometimes children are, and if it's we're talking about children here, they're less likely to listen to a parent than they would be to someone else. But if you can partner with a clinician in helping someone remember that the misery they experience some of the time is not constant, then that can be very helpful. I think if you're talking about a spouse or someone who's, you know, a sibling, maybe you can say to them, look, you know, I know you're miserable now, but do you remember yesterday when we were talking, you actually seem to be feeling okay. Can you try to hold on to that for at least a little bit right now to soothe yourself?
And can these positive recollections help move them towards recovery, do you think?
Well, to the extent that they help with the stress tolerance and mood regulation, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think that if people can hold on, because part of what the ability to conjure up positive mood states does is it can nurture hope, and hope is enormously important if someone's going to get better.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Brad, thank you so much for a very clear and lucid and stimulating presentation and for sharing your clinical experience, expertise, and your wisdom with us tonight. And we have to wrap things up. Sorry for folks that we didn't get to other questions. Hopefully at some point we can have you back and have another more extended discussion. Next week, our internationally recognized Connecting the Dots call-in show will be here on the 20th. The week after that, there's inauguration and Martin Luther King holiday, and we will have a break. And at the last Sunday of the month, we will Milt Brown, who is visually handicapped but has been very productive working with Marsha Linehan's group, will present some innovative and very intriguing work. Thank you again. Everybody have a great week. I hope the holidays went well, and call in next Sunday. Bye-bye, all.